Oui.
Thank you, Trey. Good evening, everyone. I'm Steve Lee. I'm an alcoholic. I'm really thrilled to be here. I really appreciate being invited to spend the weekend with you guys. It's always a treat for me. But I have some ties to this area that I'll talk a little bit more about as the talk evolves. But I'm thrilled to be here. I've got so many friends in the area, and it's just fun to visit. Trey's been great. I appreciate being invited. Actually, Trey hasn't been that great, but I'm just so used to saying that, you know. But actually, he's been average at best. But I will say that there was a he said that attendance went down, and I'll thin this herd as well. About the second or third time that I was speaking, when I lived in Richmond, Virginia, I'd been invited to speak at a meeting. Actually, it was about this size, and at the time, it was far and away the largest group that I'd ever spoken before. I'd spoken at a few little group meetings, and I was talking to my sponsor, and I was nervous and anxious, and I said, "Joe, this is the biggest crowd I've ever spoken before." And he said, "Steve, don't worry." He said, "By the time you're done, it'll be down to the size you're used to." That could happen, but either way, I'm going to use my time whether you stay or not. So I hope I use it doing what you invited me to do, which is at the end of the day, tell you the truth about me as best I can. And I always tell people that I'm absolutely committed to being honest with you tonight. But I have to say just as quickly that I'm often honestly mistaken. So there are times that I'm even wrong about what happened to me. So when I share with you, as we often do, say that I'm going to tell you what I was like and what happened and what I'm like today, in truth, what I'll be doing is sharing with you my experience of what I was like. I'll share with you what it was like from the inside looking out. I'll share with you what my alcoholism and what my life looked and felt like from here. But I've come to know over time that often other people in the same place at the same time were having a different experience. We're seeing things differently. I sometimes suffer from a past that never actually happened. And I know that we see things differently sometimes. A number of years ago, I went to Myrtle Beach to a conference, and I had never met my host, and yet we had talked on the phone a number of times, as Trey and I did, and he was going to pick me up at the airport. I got there, and we were having trouble connecting, I was down around the baggage claim, and finally we're on our cell phones, and I'm saying, "Man, I'm over here by baggage claim number 6. I don't see you." He went, "No, Steve, I'm at baggage claim number 6, right now." And I said, "No, you couldn't be," and we're finally we made contact. And we realized the reason we'd had such a hard time connecting is we'd both described ourselves as much more attractive than we really are. And so I tell you quite literally that how I see me is not always how other people see me, externally and internally. And how I see you is never the whole picture. So I want to be sure not to always, I'm always drawing conclusions. I'm always have an idea of what I think you think. My sponsor shared with me at a few years sober. I'd been at a meeting in Richmond, Virginia. I spoke at great length and eloquently, I'm sure. But it wasn't a speaker meeting. I called my sponsor Joe. I was worried about that, starting to feel, and I called him after I got home. He had been at the meeting, and I said, "Joe, did I sound self-righteous in that meeting?" And he said, "Steve, you're still asking the wrong questions." He says, "Because the question isn't, did you sound self-righteous? The question is, were you self-righteous?" And he said, "See, you don't really care if you were self-righteous. You're afraid they think you're self-righteous. You're afraid they're driving home going, 'Boy, that Steve's a self-righteous son of a gun.'" And he said, "See, if you weren't self-righteous, don't worry about it. If you weren't, try not to do it again." He says, here's the key, Steve. He says, you're not who you think you are. You're not who they think you are. And you're sure as hell not who you think they think you are. And again, kind of a laugh line, but I've lived most of my life based on that. I've made life-changing decisions based on what I think you think. I've spent my life trying to calculate how this is going to look, the effect it's going to have, how's it going to work, how's it not going to work. Sometimes it was to offend you. Sometimes it was to win your affection. But whatever it was, I am trying to think what you think. And I'm wrong about that. I'm almost always wrong. So what that tells me is I've been going through my life aiming at the wrong target. I've been forever trying to solve this external problem that in fact is an internal problem. I've been trying to find some way to connect on a false way with the world and its people, when in fact what I've got to do is find authentically who I am, and the connections then will begin to be authentic. When our 12 and 12 talks about the fact that one of my primary problems is an inability to form a true partnership with another human being. How can I have a true partnership if I'm not bringing truly who I am to the partnership? If I'm not bringing me to a relationship, how can it be a sound relationship? How can it be real? As so many of my relationships were over the years, it's going to be superficial because I start from that place. I didn't give you a chance to see who I really was. I didn't know who I really was, and I certainly didn't even really know how to show you that. Now, here's what you already know. I didn't plan to say any of that. So while I'm committed to trying to do what you invited me to do, it will not happen in any particular order. So my story is kind of like a Quentin Tarantino movie where there is just no time and space continuum. I'll tell a host of seemingly unrelated stories and hope at the end of the hour somehow that made some kind of sense. But if not, I'll be fine. I'm driving back to Nashville Sunday. The opportunity that we have with each other. And tonight I get to do it from the podium, but really what we bring to Alcoholics Anonymous, the primary thing of value we bring is the truth about ourselves. And that's why all of us need to tell our stories. You're going to recognize pretty quickly, if you haven't already guessed it, that I don't have a dramatic story. I'm not a tough guy. I'm just kind of the poster boy for middle-class alcoholism. I'll frame my story around a few few of the exciting moments, if you will. We tend to do that from the podium, is bookend our stories with some of the big crash and burn moments. But the truth is, on me and on so many people I know, alcoholism is really just a day-by-day, tacky, tawdry disease that has me brick by brick eating away at the relationships and betraying the trust of the people I love the most. It's not always a big crash and burn. It's just nick away. It's tacky, it's pitiful, it's tawdry, and that's what it looks like on me, and it feels like that. And while the external challenges and consequences of my alcoholism are some that I will share, I have almost an inability to articulate the internal feelings that were really at the core, that were really the bottom. When we talk about a bottom, it's this feeling that's almost hard for me to articulate, though I'll spend about the next hour and a half trying. The herd will have thinned by then, I know. Anyway, I've got a sobriety date. It's June 30th, 1989, and I have a home group. It's the backroom group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet in Nashville every Saturday and Sunday morning at 9 and 10:30. We have a literature study at 9 and a topic discussion meeting at 10:30. I'll be here tomorrow when they meet. I had a friend text me. It was a close vote. They decided to have the meeting in my absence anyway. Some sharing time has opened up at the backroom group. They'll drive in from all areas of the city now. But I'm thrilled to be here, and I feel privileged to be invited. I told you my sobriety date's June 30th of 89. I'll share with you then that what I always say is the most embarrassing part of my story. And that's my last drink. And actually, I don't know if it's my last drink. It's the last time I've had a drink. And I will tell you, I didn't anticipate going from that night till this between drinks. But I don't take for granted that it's my last one. I just can mark the time between then and today. But it was June the 29th, and I was out with my wife and three other couples. And wasn't a particularly raucous evening. We went out to dinner. I was actually scheduled to go to a treatment facility on July the 1st of 1989. And I say scheduled because that's exactly the case. I had been... not because I had some epiphany that I needed or wanted to stop drinking, not because I thought my life needed some moral uplift. I was going specifically and singularly to fulfill my obligation to the legal system of Williamson County, Tennessee, for the conviction of my 6th DUI a year before. And as a result of that plea bargain agreement, they gave me some jail time, and they cut some of that jail time off if I would agree to go to residential drug and alcohol rehabilitation. And I wasn't really familiar with what, I mean, certainly I'd heard that language, but I didn't really know what that meant. I didn't know what it would entail, but I did the math very quickly, and I knew that a 28-day stay in a residential drug and alcohol rehabilitation center and 10 weekends in jail came out to 48 days versus 60 days in jail, and so by virtue of 12 days, I'm here with you tonight. It was strictly a math problem that I did. And my wife and I were going out with these three other couples for kind of a, last hurrah. And again, I came home after we got back to our house. I had an amaretto on the rocks and smoked a joint and went to bed. I mean, amaretto as a last drink. Well, clearly you now know I didn't know it was going to be my last drink, because I would not have gone down like that. And particularly had I known that I would be sharing this story, over and over, because this would have been a colorful ending. This would have had a movie type crescendo. But I just had a little amaretto, smoked a joint, and went to bed. Got up the next day. My wife and I were spending June the 30th with our daughter Abby, who was 5 years old at the time, and we were going to, take her to Chuck E. Cheese before Daddy went away on a 28-day business trip. And and while I've shared with you that I'm not a tough guy and don't have a lot of tough stories, I beg of you, if you have not stopped drinking yet, do not spend your first day sober at Chuck E. Cheese. It was a hellish day at Chuck E. Cheese. Well, anyway, it's loud in there. They're coming at you from every angle, and just as I'm gathering my emotional balance, I saw a 6-foot mouse, and I said to Connie, "Baby, do you see the mouse?" And July the 1st, my friend Ricky came by to drive me off to treatment. And I hope we have a good time tonight, and I do. And I think that our book says that cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness. But I don't ever want the message to get lost in the laughter. And if you're new, I know you already know that while we'll get a laugh today, because when we look back at these things and when we share these stories with each other, we can see the absurdity of life as I was living it. I can see it now, but man, none of this was funny while it was happening. Not a bit. Life was hard. Life was, again, uncomfortable. Life was exhausting. It was exhausting pretending to be okay, pretending to act like I had it together, yet carrying around these feelings that I frankly didn't even know were alcohol. I drank and got in a lot of trouble drinking. I had alcohol-related problems. I could connect the dots on my alcohol-related problems. DUIs, arrest, humiliating people around me while drunk. Drunken behavior. See, drunken behavior looks a lot alike on an alcoholic and a heavy drinker. Drunken behavior means I put enough alcohol in me that the alcohol is now, it has diminished my capacity. It is having me acting in a way that and I'm not talking about here the phenomenon of craving, the allergy. I'm just talking about I'm drunk. I can explain anything I ever did while drinking. I was drunk. But what I had no clue about was that I had alcoholism even when I wasn't drinking. So the feelings that I had sober were the feelings that seemed to separate me from other people. My behavior drunk separated me from the people who didn't drink or didn't drink like I did. But the way I felt sober was a thing that I thought was singular unto me. And that I thought, this is one of the things that makes me different. I think that's one of the things that so many of us talk about when we come to AA and say we don't feel a part of and we feel different. There's a lack of connection. And this lack of connection is what I couldn't understand. I couldn't understand why I was sitting at my desk on a Tuesday afternoon with a good job that made pretty good money and a wife that loved me and a kid that loved me and a house and a couple of cars and a middle class life externally. So why do I feel the way I feel? What's missing? What's missing? And I don't know that until after I get to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know my problem. I'm a guy that got sent to Alcoholics Anonymous or had a chance to make that choice rather than jail. And so I'm a guy that didn't come to AA to quit drinking either. So I'm a guy that's really grateful that you don't have to believe what AA says before you get to AA, because I didn't know what alcoholism was until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know until I got a chance to hear you guys share about your alcoholism, and I began to read in our book, and I began to see those things that gave voice to my alcoholism, that helped me. You would say something that I didn't know was true about me a minute before, and then you would say it, and I'd go, that's it. That's it. Or I would read something, it might be related to my drinking, it might be related to the way I feel, it might be related to my relationship with alcohol between drinks, but I go, that's it. You know, and just down the road from here in 1980, I lived here in Atlanta in 1979 and 80. I lived at Riverbend Apartments just down the road. 79 and 80, that was not a bad place. Well, it was depending on your perspective whether that was a good or bad place. I actually think I was on the tail end of Riverbend being a cool place to live. And the truth is, I've been just a tad behind the trends all of my life. But there was a lot happening there, and I was, you know, and yet I was down here, I was alone and lonely, and they're different, but I was alone and lonely. I didn't know many people, was just kind of, you know, running the traps. I was here because I'd moved here for business, and you know, I'd been over to, I spent a lot of time at Billy's at Buckhead, if you guys remember that place, and then I was just down here and off Sandy Springs and Roswell Road at the TGI Fridays in a place called Daddy's Money. And in my case, it should have been Mama's Money. But I left there one night. I'd been at that TGI Fridays one afternoon throwing back kamikaze shooters and taking two-and-alls. And I came out of there and I got on I-285 going east into westbound lane. And I hit a car head-on and two other cars hit us and totaled all four cars. I came to in the jail. I had urinated on myself and I'd vomited on myself, or you know, I hope I did, because somebody did. If you go down in the drunk tank, you know, the stains you wake up with may or may not be of your own making. But I prefer to think that's an indignity I inflicted on myself. But in all honesty and earnestness, I'm sitting there that morning in that jail cell, in that state, in my own urine, in my own vomit, with a hazy recollection of what had happened, because I'm a blackout drinker, and I lose time. It doesn't require much drinking for me to do that. I love what the comedian David Tell said. He said he's a blackout drinker, or as he likes to call it, time travel. And I get that, you know, because it's like, whoa, you know, how did I get here in the future, and what has been going on? And if you're like me, I don't ask direct questions to get that answer. You know, you sort of read people's faces, you know, and you're like, oh, you know, was I just kind of cute last night, or did it go really off in the weeds and stuff? But I'm there that morning in that jail cell, and never, never had I been more afraid of the consequences, personally, professionally, legally, that awaited me. Never had I been more ashamed of what I'd done and the harm I'd caused other people. It had sent people to the hospital. I didn't yet know the extent of the injuries. They turned out not to be life-threatening, but I was sued over that years later, as I should have been. I was as humiliated as I'd ever been, sitting there in the drunk tank in my own urine, in my own vomit. I'd been in the drunk tank before. I'd been in the drunk tank a number of times, but if I've got this quality, and maybe some of you possess it, when I'm in the drunk tank, I'm kind of a visitor to a strange land. And the other people kind of belong there, you know? I mean, somehow I think that I'm different, yet I'm there. I've got this capacity. But that morning, I felt like I belonged there. And so I'd never been as afraid, as ashamed, as humiliated, nor had I ever been as certain that I'll never drink again. Because I've crossed a line now that even I can't live with. I'm done. And 10 days later, I'm driving around here smoking a joint, drinking a bottle of wine, thinking I nearly overreacted to that. And I realize when I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, when I read in our book, when it says on page 24 that there'll come a time that for a guy like me, an alcoholic of my type, won't be able to bring to consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. I'll be without defense against the drink. When I read that, I went immediately, not just to that jail cell and that event, but so many events in my life when I was going to do better, when I was convinced. And not knowing I don't have the power to do better, not knowing that I couldn't attack my alcoholism or my problematic alcohol use, as I might refer to it, with firm resolve, with intellect, with an absolute conviction that I'm going to do better. Because I don't understand the lack of power of the problem I've got. I don't understand that this isn't about me coming head on at my problem. It's not about me using all of my willpower to defeat this problem. It's about me totally redirecting my willpower. It's about me turning away from my problem toward the solution. When Alcoholics Anonymous says that lack of power is my dilemma, I don't think it's necessarily saying that lack of power is my problem. Lack of power over alcohol would not be my problem if I knew I didn't have power. It's not the not having power that's a problem. It's acting like a guy acts when he thinks he's got power. It's trying to use power I don't have. It's trying to come at my alcoholism with my power. What you guys say and what our book says is that it's not the lack of willpower that's my problem. It's the misuse of willpower. And in our book, it tells me later that the proper use of the will is to try to align my will with God's will. So I quit spending time trying not to drink, trying not to do this stuff, and turn around and do what Alcoholics Anonymous is encouraging me to do, which is to build a relationship with a power greater than myself, which can solve my problem. It dawns on me when I'm going through the process of these steps and I get to the 10th step, and it suggests that I'll be in this, that as alcohol is concerned, I'll now react sanely and normally. And that I'll be placed in a position of neutrality. And that this new attitude toward liquor will have been given me with no thought or action on my part. And I'm confused when I realize, what do you mean no thought or action? I've been thinking a lot about this, and I've been working hard. But what I realize now, I believe, at least a personal interpretation, is that my thought or action in Alcoholics Anonymous isn't about changing my attitude toward liquor. My thought or action is about building a relationship with a higher power, and my attitude is changed. I have a psychic change. This is a result. It's not because I got smarter. It's not because you talked me out of it. It's not because I read something. It's because I took a set of actions that are laid out before me that change who I am, that bring about a profound alteration in my reaction to life. So this new attitude toward liquor shows up when I'm doing this other stuff you encourage me to do. So anyway, let's go back to Ricky picking me up and taking me to the treatment center. I don't want to get too sober too quick. So Ricky picks me up. My wife, Connie, walks out. Connie couldn't be with me tonight. She sends her love. She sends me. And she was not frankly unhappy to see me go. The last two nights, I'm afraid my snoring has sent her to the couch. So she'll get a good weekend sleep, and I'll help you guys go to sleep too, some of you right away. But at any rate, Connie walks out with me and gave me the kind of support that a lot of my AE brothers and sisters don't get from their spouses. As I'm getting ready to head off, she says, "No matter what, baby, don't stop drinking." And she said, "Go do your time, and then come back, and we'll get back on." Because Connie and I met over a pile of cocaine, and it was hers. And I know it's an easy one, but yes, I wanted what she had. Year later, we're dating. We went to Mexico on a little vacation. We drank something out of a coconut. We got on a boat and went out to international waters, and an Austrian captain read a wedding ceremony in Spanish, so he said. We're not even sure what he... I might need to talk to our Spanish interpreter here tonight to... Because I was pretty sure he said something to her about love, honor, and obey, but clearly that was not the case. At any rate, so we had been drinking and drugging together for 7 years of our marriage, and apart. We were together, but sometimes we ran separately. So it's not like she didn't want me to stop drinking. She wanted me to amend my behavior. She wanted me to drink with different people at different places at different times, maybe with her, but not at some of the other things I was doing. Ricky's driving me off. He said, "Steve, what do you think this deal's going to be like, man?" And I'm going to tell you, I didn't have a clue. I was afraid. I was anxious, uncertain, insecure. I was angry. I didn't feel like it was fair. Somehow I still thought I didn't deserve to have to pay for the consequences of my actions. I couldn't articulate how I felt, but I said, "I'll tell you one thing." And I said, "I'm not getting in some little circle and going, 'I'm Steve, I'm an alcoholic,' and whine about the most intimate details of my life to a bunch of strangers." About 3 weeks later, I was just telling people more than they wanted to know about me. I got to be honest, I started making stuff up right away. Because Amaretta and Chuck E. Cheese will get you no street cred in the treatment facility. You got to bring a little bigger game. And I'll tell you what, I'm pretty sure I punched that story up for a while in AA, but here's what I've come to know and believe for myself. Then in working with others, it says we tell the new man exactly what happened to us. And for me to step back from something that did happen and hide it under a bushel, or to embellish or make up something that didn't happen, is an equal sin. And while it is a disservice to you and Alcoholics Anonymous, it is a danger to me. So I know that my story doesn't resonate with everyone. And my guess is that your story doesn't resonate with everyone, which is why ultimately we all tell our stories. And sometimes we do it from the podium, and sometimes we do it in our home group, and sometimes we do it over a cup of coffee. And frankly, the cup of coffee story is probably the most effective one. And we tell the truth about ourselves. And that's what the family afterwards says, that perhaps the primary thing I bring of value to my family is the truth about me. My daughter knows everything about me she wants to know. I told her at one point and wrote a letter to her at 12 years old. She heard me tell my story for the first time. And it was Father's Day, and I wrote her a little letter on that Father's Day, and I promised her at that time, I said, "You come to me anytime and ask me anything, and I will tell you the truth." And I will say that she asked me a lot of things, and she was a wise young girl, and there's some things she chose not to ask, and I think she chose on purpose. But her mother and I have shared the truth about ourselves with her from day one. I get out there at the treatment center, and I go in, and they gave me a test right away. They call it an assessment. Most of you guys have had some version of it. If you haven't taken it at the treatment center, versions of this are in magazines. It's kind of the AA version of "you might be a redneck if." And ask these questions, right? And the questions at this particular, they're a little different these days than they used to be, because today they're much more geared toward meeting criteria for insurance. And so it's those types of things. Here they would just kind of get a feel for my drinking. And they ask questions like, "Have you ever drank in the morning?" Have you ever drank alone? Have you ever had a blackout? Have you ever had a DUI? Have you ever had trouble at work because of drinking? Have you ever had trouble at home because of drinking? There were 30 have you ever questions, which, as you know, just have check yes or check no to what I think are clearly essay questions. Because they said even once means even with a really good reason. And so again, we laugh, but I'm unable to check this box, because how can they do this? How they're going to assess me? They're going to draw conclusions about me based on how I check this yes or no answer without understanding the backstory or the context or what brought this about. And again, we're laughing, but I promise you that these are the thoughts I'm, because one of my problems is I think I know what they're asking. They're asking me, have you ever drank in the morning? I've got questions about the questions, you know. I said, what do you mean morning? And the reason that's a legitimate question in my mind is because, once again, I think I know what they're asking. So I think they're asking, am I that guy that's reaching over and has to grab that half pint off the nightstand at you know, 4:30 or 5 in the morning just to get his heart started, just to calm the shakes, just to be able to get in there and brush his teeth? And while I've done that a few times, not so often I'm checking it on this test. But my thought is, but what if I'm at a very nice place? What if that Billy's at Buckhead at 2 a.m. At last call? I mean, that's technically morning drinking. And if I don't distinguish the difference between, you know, you might think I'm like that guy sucking off that half pint. You know, you might room me with a guy like that here. You know? Have you ever drank alone? You know? Yeah, but they left. Did it ever happen? You ever just go, whoa, you know, where did everybody go? And but there's another kind of alone drinking, you know, because see, I think I know what they're asking again. I think they're asking if I'm that guy that's got to come home and close the door and pull the shades and turn the lights down. And it used to be unplug the phone, but now it's silence the phone and drink in isolation and hide from the world. And certainly I've done that a few times, but again, not so often I'm checking it on this test. And the other kind of alone drinking that a guy like me did is I'm a guy that had to drink to go drinking. Now, is that, if I'm drinking, getting ready to go meet them somewhere, is that alone drinking? And I am just wrapped up trying to think through these questions. Now, I didn't do very well on the test, but here's the news. I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys share with me is how I check those boxes is not what makes me alcoholic. Those are the types of questions that might expose alcoholism. They might shine a light on it. Those are the types of questions that identify the consequences of my alcoholism, the things that I have to do because I'm alcoholic. But you helped me see finally the description of alcoholism that I could grab hold of that allowed me to be alcoholic was that short description that says that if when I honestly want to, I find I can't stop entirely. And if when drinking, I have little control of the amount I take, I'm probably alcoholic. And when I got where I could honestly lay my life experience over that, I could see that both sides of that equation fit me. That I'm a guy that couldn't stay stopped. I'm a guy that meant to. I'm a guy that in that jail cell in 1980 decided to stop entirely. And then after a little while, I said, wait a minute, that's an overreaction. Actually, when I left the courthouse from that 60 UI after the plea bargain agreement, they had been trying to put me in jail for a year because I'd had these multiple DUIs and car crashes and stuff like that, and I guess today I probably would end up in jail for a year. The laws have stiffened quite a bit, but as I'm leaving, they said, look, Steve, if you get arrested for any drug or alcohol related offense during this year, you go straight to jail. No, you know, no $200 for pass and go. You're going straight to jail for violation of the terms of probation. And so I decided not to drink for this year, not for any reason other than to avoid the consequences that would be in front of me. And I'm walking to my car with this firm conviction not to drink for the year of this probation. And I sometimes say I just park too far from the courthouse, because while I'm walking to my car, I'm thinking. And as I thought about it, I said, well, wait a minute. The real problem is this driving and drinking. And so here's the deal. I will not drink and drive, or drive and drink. Whichever one of those I start first, I will not do the other one. And I'm firmly, again, convicted to this. And again, we laugh here. But to me, this is linear thinking. When I'm just thinking, and I'm going, I'm just not going to drink and drive for sure. I mean, no question, because that's a problem. And I'm still walking to my car, and I'm still thinking. And I arrived, my plan took on one more revision, and by the time I got to the car, the new plan was I won't drink much when I drive. And again, here we know how ludicrous that is, but for a guy who doesn't know he's alcoholic and doesn't know what alcoholism is, I still suffer from the delusion that I can control and enjoy my drinking. That great obsession. And that great obsession, by the way, control and enjoy on me does not mean don't get drunk. I mean, I never spent any time trying to drink just enough not to know I'd been drinking. You know, when I drink, I want to feel differently than before I started. So I want to get drunk. I don't want to get too drunk. And here here's just drunk enough. And just drunk enough is to drink enough to get everything alcohol does for me without suffering any of the pains of what it began to do to me. Just drunk enough is the good times and not the bad times. Just drunk enough is spending, you know, my drinking was like a game of Wheel of Fortune. And I got a progressive disease, and I don't know that, right? So when I start playing Wheel of Fortune, you know, in my early days, I 90% of the wheel is good stuff. 90% of the wheel is the party, the girl, the running with your buddies, the ball game, the golf weekend. And every now and then in there is, you know, okay, maybe a little fender bender, maybe you miss class, some embarrassment. But over the years, people were screwing with my wheel. And pretty soon I'm spinning that wheel and it's about 50-50. Then it's about 70-30 and it's DUI and car crash and cheat on your wife and drunk at the hospital when your daughter's born and going the wrong way down I-285 and hitting a car head on. And every now and then, the party. Every now and then, that flimsy reed that I would grab hold of is when it would seem to go well again. And I would hope I could recreate that, as our book says, that I would hope for those great moments of the past, but they're gone. They're gone. I wanted what our book describes back in A Vision for You, what it says most normal folks get from a few drinks. Most normal folks get conviviality, joyous intimacy with friends, colorful imagination, release from care, boredom, and worry, and a feeling that life is good. I mean, I got a little thirsty just saying it. That's an attractive package, but that's not what I get. It says maybe momentarily I get something. Maybe, you know, I don't know when it is. Maybe my fourth or fifth drink or whatever, you know, whatever it is somewhere. And it says momentarily, so I'm passing right by it. It's just like momentarily today, I sped by mile marker 232, you know. But I didn't spend any time there. I just momentarily went by it. And I seemed to momentarily go by that conviviality, that joyous intimacy with friends. And then I wake up with what our book says. I go into oblivion, awakening to face the hideous four horsemen of terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. I mean, I just want a little joyous intimacy with friends, and I wake up with these four SOBs, you know. Who let you guys in, and where did she go? All of that. So, you know, that's the way my alcoholism begins to. And yet, I don't know it. See, anything that I share with you about my alcoholism, I'm sharing in the rearview mirror from today's perspective. Because sometimes I know when at least I used to listen to people speak from the podium, and it sounded like they knew what was happening to them while it was happening. And in my case, I can promise you, life was just happening to me. You know, my friend Bob B says life is fired at point blank range. And that's what, boom, I'm just reacting to life. I couldn't explain what's going on in my life to you. It would be impossible for me to do so. I got out of that treatment facility, and somewhere in that 28 days, I decided that I needed to stop drinking. I don't know if it was yet that I wanted to, but I decided I needed to, and I decided I was going to. I'm going to try to not drink. And AA is how I'm going to try to not do it. And I didn't yet know really what that was going to require. I didn't yet certainly understand. I mean, we were doing some 12-step stuff. We're going out to meetings. But, I mean, I didn't. When I was even then saying out loud I was alcoholic, I wasn't saying it with the full understanding of the ramifications. You know, I'm pleading guilty to a crime I don't quite understand. I don't really know what's behind all of this. I don't understand that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem. I don't really understand this strange mental blank spot where alcohol is concerned. I don't quite understand that the problems of the alcoholic arise from within. I don't really have all that. I just know, hey, I drink and I get in trouble and I probably should not drink anymore. And I'm going to try not to. And so I'm going to do that. Now I'm going to do that with all the same conviction that I was going to not drink before, but I'm going to do it at Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was prepared to, but if you're new, I will tell you what it seemed like I was committing to. It seemed like that my life was about to get really small. And my life was going to be all about where I can't go, what I can't do, who I can't talk to. It's going to be a very restrictive life. It's going to be full of self-sacrifice. I'm going to not drink. I thought not drinking was an actual activity in Alcoholics Anonymous, that we will get together and not drink. And guys would call, hey, Steve, Sunday, we're going to go to the Titans-Falcons game. Would you like to go? Boys, I'd love to go, but I'm busy Sunday. I'll be home not drinking. And I'll just not drink. Somebody said, don't drink if your ass falls off. You know, I'll be home not drinking, guarding my ass. But I'm just going to not drink, and I'm going to hold on tight and not drink, and we'll come get together at these meetings, and we'll talk each other out of a drink, and that'll be good, but that's what it's going to be. I heard a woman came into one of the meetings that I go to a few months ago, and she was just a month or two sober, and I mean, she came in, she was just ecstatic, you know, and she had gone to dinner with her husband, which was like a big a rite of passage, because to go and for her not to have a drink at dinner was going to be a challenge. And she said she got it, and she looked over, and there was a neighboring table. There were four women from the group that she regularly attends. And she said they were sitting there eating and not drinking. And I just had this vision of them just actively not drinking over there, you know, that's what she saw was people not drinking. And that's what I thought I was signing on for, see? But boy, that hasn't been the case for me. Now, look, there's a period of time where I gotta cooperate and participate and try not to drink, use my willpower while I wait for this other power to tap into that power which will solve my problem. But this would be a long place to stay since 1989, not drinking. That's just an exhausting, hard thing. So that hasn't been my experience. But I pop out of that treatment center and I go down in Nashville to the Friendship House 202. That's now a 52-year-old kind of AA clubhouse in town. I wandered upstairs and kind of fell in with the people that really formed the foundation for my early recovery, and really my recovery today. And it was really by happenstance or God's grace, but because there are three meetings going on at any given time, I walked upstairs and wandered into the smallest of the three rooms at 1 o'clock on a Tuesday afternoon. And the man who would be my sponsor was in there, and they were having a book study. I didn't even know there was a different type of meetings, and that there was a book study. And downstairs at what Frank referred to as the half measures table, they were fairly critical of that group up there and called them big book thumpers when it wasn't a term of endearment. But that's not what I saw, you know, and that's not what they offered me. What they were doing in there was looking in the book where the integrity of our message is protected. not as an intellectual exercise, not to quiz each other, not to thump each other, but to look for ways to put this into application in my life, to save my life, to change my life. And these book studies at their best, and I fall into every trap that we have, and the one I fall into sometimes most often is to turn Alcoholics Anonymous into an intellectual exercise. And I can sit in a book study and begin to parse words and begin to debate what he meant or they meant and stuff like that, and I will lose the spiritual experience that's what's happening. And it is not about the information, it's about the application that brings about the transformation. And I'll get hung up in the information. It's important, but only as I can put it into practical use in my life. Frank became my sponsor, and the people in that room, many of them are still my friends today. And I'm a little emotional because I've talked to a few of them in the last week, and anyway, I can just still see their faces, and we're spread out a lot of different places now, but a number of them are still sober and still just have such a soft spot in my heart for them. But I had a little problem. I'm coming to AA, and I'm beginning to love AA. I mean, I'm fascinated by the men and women in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, this is just you're interesting people. I mean, it's the Jerry Springer show every day, and without the paternity test, and actually sometimes with the paternity test, but with a solution. But we bring this stuff, and sometimes it sounds absurd, but we're there opening up and sharing with each other. So I'm loving AA. But I'm just kind of, what I'm not doing is when you get up at the end of the meeting and hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer, I wouldn't stand in the circle. I'd step back from it. And, part of it was just self-importance and a look-at-me moment. I didn't see it, but it was somehow me just still staking some ground of independence, you know, and not wanting to be an AA lemming like I thought other people were. But really, it was fear and insecurity and confusion, and I didn't know what I believed. And so I wouldn't get in the circle and hold hands. A guy that had been a counselor at the treatment facility that I went to was also active in some of the meetings I was at, and he pulled me aside one night. He said, "Steve, what's that all about, man?" I said, "I don't know what I believe, and I don't want to be a hypocrite." And I said, "I'm not just going to hold hands and sing Kumbaya with the rest of the campers just because that's what y'all are doing." And he said, "Well, Steve, I got good news and bad news for you." This guy had heard my treatment center fifth step, which was in effect a confessional to the extent that I could confess then of the tacky, tawdry things. It certainly wasn't some of the deep-rooted things, but just a confession of behaviors in a lot of areas of my life. And he said, "Hypocrisy." I said, "What's the bad news?" He said, "The bad news is hypocrisy's way down your list of problems." And you might ought to address them in the order in which they will kill your ass. I said, "What's the good news?" He said, "The good news is there's room for another hypocrite in Alcoholics Anonymous." Because he said, "Let me get this straight." And again, I shared this confessional with him. So he knew these things, you know, infidelities in my marriage. He knew that drunk when my daughter was born. He knew the car wrecks. He knew the stealing money from my family business, money and time. And he said, "But hypocrisy." He said, "That's where you draw the line." He said, "That is impressive, Steve." So I'm grateful. When he said that there's room for another hypocrite in Alcoholics Anonymous, what he's telling me is just come on. Get in the game. Yeah. You don't have to believe everything. We will come to believe. Now, that's where I had another problem, right? Because you guys are telling me, "I don't know what I believe about this God," and you're saying, "Hey, Steve, get a God of your own conception." And I'm hearing you, and I'm reading it, God is my understanding. I understand him. I see that. But what I believe is you're just kind of patting me on the head, condescending to me, saying, "Come on, just," and pretty soon you'll come around to our way of belief. So you just believe whatever you want and stay with us and come around. What I believe today is that AA means what it says. And I believe that I get to have a God of my understanding. And I believe that I get to have this relationship that might look and sound quite different than yours. And that's where I found great comfort. But at that time, I wasn't there. I wasn't able to do these things. I was struggling with this. But I was able, at his urging and with that proclamation about hypocrisy, to begin to hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer and be a greater part of AA. At about 6 months sober, I realized something that I don't know how I missed before. But I'm coming to meetings and going home, and I'm coming to meetings and going home. And finally, one Saturday, I'm in a meeting, and 11:30 to 12:30, a midday meeting. And at the end of the meeting, somebody said, "Hey, we're all going to lunch. Who wants to go?" I'm sure they'd been doing that all along, but I'd not heard it, and I desperately wanted to go. Desperately. And I got in my car and began to head over to Shoney's where we were going to go. And about halfway there, I turned off and went home. And the next week, I did the same thing, and the next week, I did the same thing, and I desperately wanted to go. But here's what was stopping me, and what was stopping me was that I was unwilling to have this awkward moment. My fear was that I would walk in, and there would be six people already sitting at a table for six. And I didn't know if they really meant me. I didn't know whether to pull up a seventh chair and have somebody scoot over in it to be tight and uncomfortable. And I didn't want to walk in and have that. I just was unwilling. I'm too self-conscious. I'm too caught up in the bondage of self to feel embarrassed. Our friend Lyle that lives down here in this area, Lyle says alcoholics would rather be dead than embarrassed. And I identify with that. What I needed, I always said, was about two or three of the guys to come over after the meeting and go, "Steve, we've been talking. We really want you to go to lunch with us. And we're just arguing over who gets to sit with you." Then I would have gone and I'd be fine. And I will tell you that I don't believe the people in my life would have described me as shy or insecure. I don't think that's because I didn't look shy and insecure. Because I didn't act shy and insecure. I acted like a guy would act if he weren't those things. I acted comfortable. I acted outgoing. I acted confident. And so I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, and again, where I find myself in our book that lets me know I'm in the right place, is when it says that the alcoholic, more than most, is an actor. He wears two faces, and it's his stage character that he wants his fellows to see. He wants to be a man of certain reputation, but in his heart he knows he doesn't deserve it. And I realize I've been living my life that way. I've been acting. Again, we can't have a real relationship because I'm pretending. And when you respond even favorably, you're responding to the fraud. That's what it feels like. At about 4 years sober, my wife and I were having real trouble. We were about to separate. We were going to a marriage counselor. Connie sobered up 10 days after I did. I don't think I mentioned that, but she didn't come to AA for almost 4 years. And she's got that story to tell. And believe me, she didn't just drink a couple of glasses of Chablis and follow me into AA. She needed AA. But she was, she's got that story to tell. And of course, I'm thinking she's our problem. I'm going to AA. People are patting me on the back, telling me how good I'm doing. And I'm still acting like I'm doing well. And we were seeing this woman together and then seeing her separately. And I'm in one of those separate sessions, only saw her about three or four times because our insurance ran out. But the seminal moment for me in that whole exercise was she just stopped me. I was prattling on about something and she stopped me. And she said, "Steve, you must really be lonely." And I thought, whoa. I mean, that was bone crushing to me. And I told her she was mistaken, by the way. But she said, "You know, I bet you're a pretty popular guy." She says, "I bet people enjoy your company." And she says, "I bet you go get 5 minutes here and 5 minutes there and 5 minutes there, and then you leave empty inside." And boy, she had unearthed my secret that I didn't even quite know. And it threw me for a huge loop because I said, if that's true, then this whole thing I've been doing is a fraud. This AA is a fraud. This whole thing's a sham. And I was really thrown, and I talked to my sponsor. I'd moved to Richmond, Virginia by now, and I had a sponsor over there named Joe Sullivan. And I talked to Joe, and I talked to two other guys all separately. And each of them said virtually the same thing. They said, Steve, no, that doesn't mean AA's not working for you. It means that AA has brought you to this point, and now it's time to put that on the table as well. Now it's time to really get in the game. It's time to take those masks down. It's time to get freer of that bondage of self. It's time to really surrender. And by the way, that's an evolution that continues to this day. It's not over. And by the way, and I backslide sometimes as well. But so that was a seminal moment for me in my recovery, in my sober recovery. To recognize that I'm sober, but my life is still unmanageable. I'm still trying to manage, by the way, what I think you think of me. I'm still trying to win this approval, project an image as such. You know, when we say in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think it was Chuck C. That said, you know, what other people think of us is none of our business. That doesn't mean I don't believe that I don't care what other people think of. What it means is I don't need to conduct my life in a way that to try to win your approval or disapproval. That Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a set of principles to live by, and you encourage me to act on principle, and the conclusions you draw about me based on that are out of my control. That's none of my business. I'm not in the image management business in AA. That's really the piece of anonymity that's critical to me, as one of the things is for me to give up the idea that I think I know who I am. And the idea that I think I know who you are. I let those things go and let you draw your own conclusions. Now, again, you talk about backsliding. I backslide on that all the time. But that's okay. Alcoholics Anonymous identifies a set of perfect principles, encourages me to point myself in that direction and settle for patient improvement. I got just a few minutes left, so I want to take a little bit of a turn. I will tell a couple of more quick stories and then kind of close. I'm over there in Richmond, Virginia, and a few things. If Frank in Nashville and that group put my foundation in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, Joe was an active service guy and put me in service, but he was also a guy that helped me begin to see how to live these principles and put them in my life to practice these principles in all my affairs. At 15 years sober, I called Joe one day and said, my brother and I were getting ready to move into an office building that we had bought. It wasn't a high rise, just a little building we bought, and we're moving our stuff into it, and we're buying some office furniture and office electronics for that. And we said, you know what, this would be a good time to buy some furniture for our home and bill it through the business while we're buying this other stuff and, you know, just take advantage of the tax advantages that come with that. I mean, I wasn't even conflicted, you know. And I called Joe. I wasn't really looking for feedback. But I was just sort of sharing with him what was going on. And he said, you know, Steve, I don't think I would do that. And he really wasn't telling me what to do, and the sponsors in my life really haven't told me what to do. He was sharing a point of view and sharing of his experience, and he said, I just don't think I would do that. And I said, well, Joe, I said, I know it sounds a little bit like tax fraud. And this is where I think sponsorship is important. He said, no, Steve, it is tax fraud. And I'm a guy, look, he's kind of a first cousin to tax fraud. This might be a tax fraud embryo, but the fact, he said, no, it is tax fraud. He said, but do what you're going to do. He says, I'm going to love you anyway. I'm not going to kick you out of the club. You know, that's all okay. He said, look, we don't quit making mistakes in Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, but what I want you to do, he says, do what you're going to do, but don't kid yourself about what you're doing. We begin, he said, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we want to see the truth and act on the truth and not some fuzzy rationalization that I give myself. And in the back in the book, in Freedom from Bondage, she talks about rationalization, and she describes it as giving a socially acceptable explanation for socially unacceptable behavior. Even calls it a form of insanity. I can't differentiate the truth from the false. So Joe gives me a perspective and a point of view. At before that, at 10 years sober, Connie and I, we had moved back to Nashville, and we were about to go bankrupt. And one of the things I talked to Joe about when I was there in Richmond and had some problems with was in how it works when it says some of us try to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil till we let go absolutely. And my interpretation of that was you're saying that I never had a good idea before I got to AA. That everything I'd learned and done was wrong, throw it all away, here's the new AA way. And Joe said, that's really not what's being said, Steve. Because I said, Joe, I showed up here with some good ideas. And he said, I believe you did. He said, I hadn't heard any of them, but I believe you did. And he said, but your problem is, and the problem of the alcoholic is you can't differentiate the good ideas from the bad ideas. They commingle. And when you get to AA, what you're being asked to do is let go of all your old ideas. It doesn't mean that some of them don't have value. It doesn't mean you're throwing them away forever. It doesn't mean they're being discarded. Set them down. Because while you're holding on to them, you are limited by what you can get with those ideas. But if you're willing to set them down and embrace, have an open mind, and go through the process of Alcoholics Anonymous, the truth will find its way back. But you might also be able to embrace a whole new set of ideas that will serve you better and help you serve others better. Don't be limited by the same package you brought here. Open up. And that's also where I was falling in trouble with this relationship with God, just still halting back and forth, not quite being able to get my arms around it. Anyway, Connie and I are moving toward bankruptcy. That doesn't happen overnight. It took a little while. We're arguing with each other. Tight finances can ratchet up the pressure in a home. And finally we did, they came by and they loaded our cars up on a flatbed truck and put a foreclosure sign in the front yard of our house. The good news was, as we were living in Nashville, the house we owned was in Richmond, so we weren't having to look at that foreclosure sign. But they did foreclose on that. We were renting a home in Nashville. They came by, got our cars on that flatbed truck. They're driving off. I called Frank. I said, Frank, man, they took our cars. He went, no, Steve. He said, they took their cars. Just to be clear, they took the cars you quit paying for. And Connie and I fought a lot. We had a fight you can't pretend you didn't have. We said stuff you can't pretend you didn't say. We were at a turning point. We were at the jumping off place. And he said, this is too hard. If we're going to fight with each other, then I can't do this. And she said the same thing. And we decided, we decided to be partners in it. We decided to quit blaming each other. We said, we can go through this together. And so we decided to get, and I got all in that marriage in a way that I had not been all in and didn't know I hadn't been all in. It was a level of commitment that I had been unable to make until that moment. And I think I'd made as much of one as I could make, but now I was driven to a point to where I could make a greater commitment. And it absolutely changed my relationship with my wife. Now, what I'll tell you, the first old idea that Joe said I needed to let go of was the idea that I think I know what just happened. And going through that bankruptcy, that looked like a bad thing. That looked like bankruptcy. When in fact it turned out to be relationship counseling. But if you come to me beforehand and say, Steve, here's the plan. Going to be about 3 or 4 years, things are going to be really tough, finances are going to be tough, you and Connie are going to fight a lot, you're going to lose your cars, you're going to lose your home, but when it's all said and done, you guys are going to be tight. I said, we will work that out another way, you know. Because I don't have the wisdom or the courage to volunteer for the things that have been most instructive in my life. But so, and that hadn't removed the fear of things when they happen in my life, but it's given me a point of view that I'm not sure where this has taken me. I'm going to be able to use this to good purpose at some point. So it's easier to take on those things in life which look bad or look unfair or look hard when they're happening, but given time and perspective, look a little differently. The last story I want to tell before I close is, and just because I like the story, and it has nothing to do with anything else I've said, but other than the fact that I spend all of my time before I got to AA and much of it since trying to solve an external problem, right? My problems look like they're out here. They look like, Frank used to say, Stephen ain't them. Steve-O, it ain't them. I'd call him at night and say, Frank, today it was looked amazingly like them. It was cleverly disguised as them today, Frank. But see, I keep thinking it's out here when our book says that my problems arise from the inside. That I'm an extreme example of self-will run right, though I usually don't think so. So I'm sitting, I go to lunch with some guys. I'm in Canada at a conference a few years ago. And they come take our lunch order. And they're coming around the table, and this is my Zen story for the night. So I know you've been waiting on it. They take my order, and I ordered the cheeseburger. And a guy next to me ordered a club sandwich, and it went around. Everybody put their order in. And we waited a while, and they came back, and they brought our orders. And they gave me a cheeseburger. And they gave the guy next to me a cheeseburger. And he starts eating that cheeseburger. And I said, man, I thought you ordered a club sandwich. And he said, so wait for it. He said, I did, but they brought me a cheeseburger. That's it. Well, I said, brother, you don't have to live like that. I said, we can get you a club sandwich. And I'm waving. I'm trying to get their attention, and I'm trying to get the waitress over. And he's going, no, Steve, I'm good. And I went, no, man, we're getting you a club sandwich. And he said, Steve, I'm good. And he wasn't just saying, I'll eat the damned old cheeseburger because that's what life gave me. He was fine with the cheeseburger. And it would have been perfectly okay for him to say, you know what, I ordered a club sandwich. Would you mind bringing me one? And they would have. No big deal. But wasn't his life better because he was okay with the cheeseburger? And I spend most of my life going through the day ordering a club sandwich and getting a cheeseburger, and it ain't okay. And it's unconscious. See, I don't know I'm walking around with these demands. I don't know that I'm waiting for you to get my order right, you know? But I'm going through life waiting for you to get my order right. And our 12 and 12 says that this isn't a life of having my demands met. It's a life of lessening my demands. I paint myself into my own corner with demands I don't even know I'm making much of the time. And if I don't do a little inventory, I don't see the selfishness and self-centeredness. I am that extreme example of self-will run right, so I usually don't think so. I legitimately don't think so. I can't see it in me. I've told you about this struggle with God that I've had, or finding a conception or something that'll work for me. I wouldn't use the word God for the first year I was sober. I used, you know, all the euphemisms, and that's perfectly okay. And I went through my book, and everywhere, all the language made me uncomfortable. Prayer, spiritual experience, spiritual awakening. So I went through my book, and I blacked out everywhere it said spiritual awakening or spiritual experience. I did it with my sponsor's awareness. Now, I used to say his approval, and he said, nah. But he was aware, and I'd read back in Appendix 2, a spiritual experience, because he had taken me there, and we'd looked at that, and I found language that was more acceptable to me, and one of the descriptions of spiritual experience in there was a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery, and another was a profound alteration in my reaction to life. And I was willing to have a personality change before I was willing to have a spiritual experience. So I wrote personality change. But I mean, my big book looked like a CIA redacted volume. But Frank said, see, Steve, he says, I don't care what you call it. I want you to have this experience. And you're hung up on language. You know, a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. He says, I don't care what you call it. I want you to have it. Quit the fight. Quit the debate. Find what works and go with it. And so I did that as best I could for a while. Ultimately, I found in We Agnostics a conception that I'm able to grab hold of. It says in there that no one can fully define or comprehend that power which is God. I found comfort in that. that no one can fully define or comprehend. So I'm comfortable when you give your description. What we spend a lot of time doing in AA is trying to describe an indescribable experience. We're trying to describe a relationship with God. I'm trying to describe to you my spiritual experience, and I don't have an adequate vocabulary to articulate that. But we all do it as best we can, and it sounds different coming from different ones of us. And I'm no longer put off by that. It used to make me uncomfortable. Then it goes on to say that deep within every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. In the last analysis, it is only there that the great reality may be found. So for me, I've just decided that's where God's hanging out, deep within me and deep within each one of you. And that has now become the connection. Where I was disconnected, that is the thing that now connects me to you. That is the commonality that I can see, namaste, as they would say in the Eastern religions. The God in me honors the God in you. Then go on, and it says that look out, though, this new relationship might be obscured or obstructed by pomp, by worship of other things, and by calamity. And pomp is a reemergence of pride and ego in me. It shows up regularly. When that shows up, it blocks me off. It blocks the power. Because I'm operating on self. Worship of other things is when I put money, property, prestige, relationships above my relationship with that power. I've inserted it in there and it's blocked off. I'm acting solo. And calamity. And calamity can be that financial decline. Calamity can be illness or disease. It can be the loss of a loved one. Or when I get home Sunday afternoon, the shows that I recorded on my DVR might not have recorded. And that sounds trivial, but here's what I've come to know that a calamity is. A calamity is anything I've decided can't be happening to me. And I am more and more willing for more and more things to happen today. That's lessening those demands. I talked to my sponsor for about an hour today on the way down here. Last week he was diagnosed with stage 4 throat cancer. He started yesterday 6 weeks or 6 weeks of daily radiation and weekly chemo. And he said, "I feel okay today, Steve." He said, "We're just going a day at a time." I said, "You've been telling me that since I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. But it's the truth. That's how we live life. That's how the good times, the bad times, the seemingly good, seemingly bad." He said, "I'm okay today." There was a guy in Nashville named Mo Holleran. Mo always used to recite the verse to a poem today. When I was driving down today, his son-in-law, Mo died in 2003. I had lunch with him about 6 weeks before he passed away, and we knew his time was short. He had cancer as well, and I asked Mo at that time if when I closed my talks, if I could close with the verse to that poem, because it meant so much to me and it described my relationship with a higher power and what's happened for me in AA. And Mo was kind of embarrassed, but he said, "Sure, you know, if you think it'll help another drunk, Steve," and it always has, because it always helps me. I'm driving down here today, and Mo's son-in-law texted me he was a month late, but he called texted to wish me happy AA birthday, my 26th anniversary last month. And I told him I was coming down here by text, and I was doing a voice text, and I said, "I'm going to I'm going to tell those people about Mo's poem." And I was doing a voice text. I didn't look at it for about 10 or 15 minutes. I finally looked at it, and it said, "I'm going to tell those people about Mo's porn." And but instead, I'm going to tell you about his poem. And the poem does explain what happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. It says, "I sought my God I could not see. I sought my soul eluded me. But I sought my fellow man and found all three." And that's really what Alcoholics Anonymous has been for me. When you peel everything else away, you guys open yourselves up to me. You allow me to share myself with you. And this power shows up in a way that I can't describe or comprehend, but works in my life in a way that is indescribably wonderful. You help me live a life that is happily and usefully whole. And I am grateful for it, but I'll never be able to demonstrate it enough. But I hope that I keep trying, and I appreciate you letting me do that tonight.